This is The Guardian.
Hi, Regid Ahmed coming to you from Gadigal land. On the Australian Politics Podcast this week, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, sits down with our political editor, Tom McElroy. Remember, there are new episodes of Australian Politics every Friday, so make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Here's Tom.
Hi, I'm Tom McElroy, political editor at Guardian Australia, coming to you from Wurundjeri land in Melbourne. My guest on the podcast this week is Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. In his first comment since the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, Albanese says the former prince has suffered an extraordinary fall from grace. But there are no plans for the latest crisis facing the royal family to spark a new referendum on an Australian republic. In domestic politics, Albanese is resolute the government won't help bring home the 34 wives and children of Australian-born Islamic State fighters stuck in Syria. But he's promised the group will feel the full force of the law if they make it back to Australia on their own. And with heated rhetoric on migration this week, he hits back at Pauline Hanson's comments about Muslim Australians, calling them divisive and predictable. Albanese makes the case for Australia as a multicultural success story in the world.
Pauline Hanson appeals to our darkest forces. I want to appeal to light and to optimism and to unity, because that's the way our country will go forward.
This is the Australian Politics Podcast. Well, Anthony Albanese, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you with us in Melbourne. Thank you very much for taking the time. We're speaking on Friday morning. It's about 12 hours since news of the arrest of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor broke. Could I ask you your response? And, of course, the former prince denies the allegations against him. What's your reaction to the news?
These are very serious allegations, and because they will be no doubt the subject of court action, I'm limited in what I can say, but people will be following the detail here. This appears to be about documents and whether they were inappropriately forwarded on to someone who wasn't eligible, classified documents. But of course, there's the bigger issue as well when it comes to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And no doubt we will wait and see where this all goes. But it's quite an extraordinary fall from grace, I must say, from someone who had such an esteemed position and was in a position really of absolute privilege. And to see this decline and fall is extraordinary.
His brother, of course, is the King of Australia. These events can feel quite remote, but, of course, they do have a link to our system of government and our democracy here. Is it time for a reassessment of those ties?
Well, I'm a Republican.
Of course.
But we had a referendum during the last term. Referendums are hard to pass in Australia. I have respect for King Charles, I must say, and for Queen Camilla. I have had a good relationship with him. He very much loves Australia, and his visit here, I must say, was a very positive one. But that doesn't change the fact that I think there should be an Australian head of state.
Are you aware of any ongoing inquiries or investigations linked to the Epstein files in Australia? Have there been approaches from authorities overseas?
No, none that I know of.
Okay. All right. Well, let me ask you about some of the other big issues in the news this week. You've been emphatic that the government won't assist the Australian citizens, women and children who are stuck in this camp in Syria to return to Australia. The obligations under international law seem a little bit more complex. Is it possible that we are taking a hardline approach that will be problematic for Australia in future, leaving children who could be radicalised in a difficult part of the world?
No, I don't think so. Look, these people made a decision to travel overseas to fight in what was essentially a war, or to provide sustenance to people who were fighters. And that is quite contrary to Australian law and quite contrary to any sense of decency here. I mean, the Islamic State sought a caliphate, which is an attack on our way of life, so I'm not sympathetic with them. I am sympathetic with the children, and it's a very difficult situation that they face, but it's one in which those responsible for them being in that position are those who put them in harm's way, and that wasn't the Australian government, quite contrary to it.
What about if they are able to make it home to Australia? They were stopped by authorities on the ground there, but potentially they could be able to return relatively soon. Of course, they have the required legal documents. How will the government respond if they do make it to Australia?
By subjecting to them to the full force of the law. So if there are any breaches of the law, then they will be charged and face appropriate action legally. We regard that as being absolutely critical. Already there is one person who's been subject to a temporary exclusion order that is as a result of the threshold being reached by the national security agencies to make that recommendation.
Do you think further temporary exclusion orders are possible or perhaps necessary for this group?
We have to follow the law as it is and the advice of the National Security Agency. So I'm not going to preempt that or to talk about individual cases. Suffice to say that we will apply the law in as a direct way as possible.
It has fed into a debate that's going on here in Australia about racism. Obviously, the One Nation leader, Pauline Hanson, made comments this week. Are you at all disappointed about the state of the debate this week? Her comments, I think, were quite racist.
Of course I am. But Pauline Hanson has made a whole career of dividing Australians, whether it be Asian Australians, Muslim Australians, Indigenous Australians. This is someone who doesn't ever look for unity. She looks for people to blame who she regards as not being like her. And she seeks to amplify grievances rather than look for solutions. And it's no way forward for our country. But that is who Pauline Hanson is. That is what she has made a career out of since her arrival in the House of Representatives way back in 1996.
We're speaking at the start of Ramadan, and I think the Lekemba Mosque is feeling the real-life force of this. They've received some threats. Yesterday in an interview you said that you saw a link between political rhetoric and these kinds of threats. How do we make sure that people at the mosque and the Islamic community around the country feel safe and aren't negatively affected by political debate?
By engaging directly with people, overwhelmingly Australians, regardless of their faith, their background, love this country. That's why they're here. And last night I was at Dandenong at the night markets to celebrate Iftar, the breaking of the fast for Ramadan. And there were people there from different countries who've come to Australia, Albania, Bosnia, the Middle East, who were all celebrating. And there was such a wonderful feel there. I was very welcomed there. We had a couple of our local MPs from those eastern suburbs of Melbourne, Cassandra Fernando and Julian Hill. There was mayors and state members, but importantly, just members of the community celebrating. There was a really positive feel there, just as at Lekemba when the night markets happen. It's a really positive thing, and I'd encourage people to go and have a look and to enjoy what is a celebration in this country. It is a good thing that last night I was there with members of the Islamic community. Earlier on in the day, I was celebrating Lunar New Year with members of the Chinese Australian community, with Gabriel Ng and members of the community. We had dancing and singing, and importantly, food and a celebration of culture. I won't say I was a terrific maker of dumplings, but I did my best. And There was a demonstration of calligraphy, an extraordinary art form as well. You know, we have a great privilege in this country of people being loyal to Australia, but also not forgetting where they're from and celebrating that. For Christians, we come up to the period before Easter, Lent. There'll be a range of celebrations there, and all of the different communities welcome other people participating in their celebrations. That's my experience. On Saturday here in Melbourne, in Box Hill, there'll be about 100,000 people at the Lunar New Year events. I'll be doing a Lunar New Year event in Sydney on Sunday. These are all positive things for Australia. And, you know, Pauline Hanson appeals to our darkest forces. I want to appeal to light and to optimism and to unity, because that's the way our country will go forward.
Do you see it as your job as the leader of the country, but also the Labor leader, to push back on political rhetoric that goes into these dark places? I think Keir Starmer, your UK counterpart, has been quite forward-leaning in saying he's going to fight back against Reform, the fringe party in the UK. Do you see yourself doing a similar thing?
I do. That's part of what I've always done, is stand up against racism in all of its forms, whether it be anti-Semitism, whether it be Islamophobia, whether it be the attacks that we saw and comments about Indian Australians, whether it be the attacks on Indigenous Australians. We know where some of this rhetoric can lead, and division has no place in this great country of ours. We are so privileged to share this continent with the oldest continuous culture on earth, but also privileged that people have come here to Australia in order to make a better life for themselves, but also for their families, for their children and generations to come.
I'm interested to ask you about the social media ban. The international response grows and grows by the week. I see the United States' suggestion that Donald Trump might himself look at a similar set of rules. France, other countries across Europe. That must be satisfying for you. How do you think the ban is going here?
It's going extraordinarily well. It's exceeded expectations. 4.7 million accounts either paused or shut down very quickly within weeks of the ban coming in on December 10 last year. But since then as well, the world was watching. This was a courageous decision that came from the grassroots up. This wasn't something that government came up with. It was parents who'd lost their young sons or daughters, channeling that trauma into not wanting other parents to go through what they had gone through. And so it has been really positive. I was going into schools at the end of last year and been talking with parents this year as well. And everywhere the feedback is positive. And the feedback from young people as well. I was talking to someone just last night who was saying that their son, who was 14, was saying to them just in the last week, oh, it's good that they don't have to deal with these devices that form of communication. They're communicating with each other. Who knew that we could actually talk with each other as we are here now?
Yeah.
Is much more direct and much more effective, I think, in communicating than through something that you don't even know whether the communication is real on the other end. Of course, we know that artificial intelligence and is playing a role. I don't look at comments on social media, but I did this week just to check, in part because of the social media ban. Some of the comments, and now the use of AI, you know, graphics that aren't really me in response, is just extraordinary. That people would go to that effort to spread hatred effectively, And so the social media ban has now been taken up, or in the process of being taken up, throughout Europe, Spain, Denmark, France, the UK, New Zealand, our neighbours, Malaysia, Indonesia. And I welcome the reports that the United States is considering action as well. A number of states in the US have already taken action. And we should be really proud, just like we're proud of Medicare and we're proud of compulsory superannuation and we're proud of women getting the vote here before other parts of the world. We should be really proud that we have led the world on something that a whole lot of people, including even the opposition's communications spokesperson, was trying to undermine it at the end of last year just before it came in. The truth is it's being replicated. That's a great thing. Social media has a social responsibility and it's being called out.
Would support from Donald Trump or increasing support from the US represent a tipping point? I mean, you can't get bigger than that, especially in tech.
It would be huge. And the fact is that a range of people said to us before we put the ban in place that this would endanger our relationship with other countries. The truth is that we did it because it was the right thing to do. And I think Michelle Rowland, as the former communications minister, and then Annika Wells, deserve a great deal of credit, as does the e-safety commissioner, who has done a fantastic job. Julie Inman Grant has been subject to a whole lot of attacks as well, and she's done a great job putting this in place.
Let me ask you about the budget. We're coming up towards a federal budget that you forecast will be a reforming budget. Is it possible that changes to capital gains tax will be one of those measures? Where are you up to on your thinking, noting that we're still a couple of months away?
We're a while away. It's the second Tuesday in May. So we'll go through our budget processes, but our tax policy is to have tax cuts on July 1 and another tax cut the year after. Our housing policy is about more supply, and that's not going to change. That's the focus that we have. But, of course, in the lead-up to budget, you'll always get speculation. We'll see what happens on budget night. But we've made no decisions beyond the policies that we put forward at the election.
There was a strong hint from Katie Gallagher, the finance minister, in estimates that it's possible that a change might be targeted. It might be just about housing, maybe just about new supply. I'm interested in your thoughts on that.
Oh, look, we've made no decisions. And Katie Gallagher will play a critical role. She has played a great role as finance minister. We've found $114 billion of savings since we came to government. We produced two budget surpluses and we've lowered the deficits that were forecast in the last Morrison-Frydenberg budget of 2022.
There's been a speculation about cuts in the federal bureaucracy, potentially trimming budgets in government departments and agencies. Is that something we should expect in this budget as the economy becomes a more complex picture?
You'll have to wait and see what's in the budget. We haven't finalised the budget yet. Obviously, we had to deal as well post-December 14 with national security issues, and that was the focus. The National Security Committee was meeting every day rather than the ERC over that Christmas period. But we'll get on with ERC meetings. We meet regularly, of course, and we did in the lead-up to MyEFO that found some good savings. We'll put together the budget, but it will be a Labor budget. It will be a budget that deals with immediate challenges, but we'll also look for how we build the future, including on productivity and how we continue to grow the economy is very important.
You've talked about childcare as one of the potential changes that you'd like to see under your prime ministership. Give our listeners an update of where we're up to in that consideration. It would be a big shift and an expensive one, I think.
We have already implemented on January 6th the three-day guarantee for childcare began. That was really important because there was actually a barrier in the way that the childcare system interacted with employment issues, so that people were stuck, if you like, in not being able to gain work but not being able to get support for the childcare subsidies. So the three-day guarantee was very important going forward. In addition to that, we've got our $1 billion fund for infrastructure so that in communities where there isn't access to childcare, in some of our outer suburbs, our regional communities, that will happen as well. On just Wednesday this week, I was in La Trobe in Tasmania in the northwest at a childcare centre that had been established there thanks to the wonderful Anne Urquhart campaign to make sure that that community that was losing its only childcare centre was able to get a temporary one established while the new one is being built. And what that does is make sure that you can have fuller participation in the workforce for women. It's part of our gender equity policy that I think when people look back at this government already in our first, you know, not yet 4 years, we have record workforce participation. We've reduced the gender pay gap to a record low. We've provided pay increases in feminised industries such as early learning and aged care that have made a real difference. We have the biggest women's health program that has ever been implemented by the government, including a range of measures in reproductive health that is so important. We've got our endo and pelvic pain clinics as well, providing support around the country. And of course, we've expanded paid parental leave and put superannuation onto paid parental leave as well, and appointed women into senior roles as firsts in the Governor General's case, Her Excellency Sam Austin. She was the second, but in a range of other areas, the first Secretary of Treasury, head of the Reserve Bank, head of ASIC, head of the Productivity Commission, to have women in those senior roles is very important. And it's no accident that my government has a majority of women, both in our caucus but also around the cabinet table.
Anthony Albanese and Tom McElroy will be right back.